Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous fireside room, today's speaker is Jim Boyer, and he will be speaking on children as meaning makers. So let's listen in on Jim Boyer.
Dealing with the primary challenge, both emotionally and cognitively, of the fact that we're born into a world from which we were embedded, literally in our mother's bodies, and then become a separate self. And this particular theory or system suggests that our life is a series of birthing selves throughout our life cycle, really. And what I like about that is how it puts the self in a place where there's an ongoing evolutionary unfolding aspect. Because one of the other themes we've been talking about in this particular series is soul and parent-child relationships, and that seems to really reflect what soul is about too—a kind of unfolding over the lifespan and discovery of self in different contexts. And it fits well too, I think, with family. If we look at family stages and that sort of a thing, infancy and latency, as we say, from 5 to 9, and all that. So I think there's an unfolding discussion of self. Hello. Yeah.
Hi, Dad.
Hello. Good. Okay. Great. Welcome.
Hello.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Welcome. I don't need to be in your class, but.
Oh. Okay.
Well, could I babysit these two, or this one? Or
oh, sure, sure. Oh, sure. Oh, no problem. Yeah, you bet. That'd be fine.
No problem. Either that, or bring them with me.
Yeah, gotcha. No problem. Sure. Yeah. Whatever you want to do. Reading upstairs. You might want to stay in the building.
If you want to go to the library, that'd be great.
That'd be good.
Okay.
Sure. That's a deal.
All right.
That's cool.
That's cool.
That's cool. Good.
Okay.
All right. Sounds good.
I'll follow you around anyway.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. I told Aaron, role modeling starts at the early age. That's great. Thanks.
How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Okay, Ben, now I want you to stay in there for the next hour. I know that'll be tough.
Okay.
Right. That's good.
I'm
sure.
Is
Jeremy
going to come too? Or is he
I would like corn too.
Sam, come here.
Can you come along? Okay. You're so cute. Ben just like bonded to Aaron so early on, and yeah, he's just following him around. It's really cute. Have you seen that a lot? Yeah, with younger. He doesn't have a lot of younger males in the neighborhood, so that's interesting.
I think it's interesting that all these parenting classes are not during the Narnia.
Yeah.
During what? The time that the kids are in Narnia.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, tomorrow's 10:30, which okay, that probably makes sense. And
like
no Narnia. And there's no Narnia tomorrow.
I recommend you do one go.
Yeah, okay.
I want to come.
Okay, well, good. Well, we just got started on the theme for today, which is meaning making in children. And what we mean by that is the whole process of the children, our children going from a state of symbiosis, we might say, connection with mother, certainly in the birth process, to a separate self. And then throughout life, involving themselves in a process that we all are involved in, and that is discovering and working out the mystery that we are separate selves related to other selves. Mm-hmm. And meaning making has to do with dealing with and making sense out of that basic reality that really all of psychology has developed around that particular mystery of life. And how we seem to resolve our conflicts and our challenges around that. So we're talking about meaning making as the child's process of coming to define themselves first within the context of their set family group, and then increasingly relating to the wider world. But we'll be looking at cycles of meaning or self. Creation, psychologically speaking, and sort of cycles that children go through, particularly the early ones in which we see that unfolding happening as parents who are blessed and burdened, both, by the presence of children in our home to watch that. And keeping an ear for, you know, what are some of the ways that we can be supportive and understanding of that. So that's the basic thing we'll be looking at. What I have on the board and want to talk through is as quickly as I can. It can be fairly complicated, but it can be also fairly simplified. Is a developmental scheme developed by a Harvard psychologist named Robert Keegan in a book called The Evolving Self, which explicates his theory that's really building up on Piaget. Who is a child really researcher who developed all those stages on cognitive development. Okay, so when we talk about development, there's a lot of big names that come to mind, Erickson and all number of different people who have offered different kinds of systems. But Piaget and Freud really would be the two, you know, major developmental persons. And we could suggest that, or it's pretty clear, that Freud, his emphasis is on emotional or impulse management. And he says that we're organized in a way that basically takes care of inner emotional stresses and has to do with resolving conflicts. And that the ego, as Freud says, is basically organized around avoiding pain and pursuing pleasure. Very simple kind of a formula, but he says that's really how the self organizes itself in the world, which is another way to talk about meaning, is how do we organize ourselves in the world. Piaget, on the other hand, focused a lot on cognitive process, and he has all the stages, you know, when child is able to know that something is still there, when it's hidden, looks at two different volumes of liquid, and even though they're different shapes, understands that they're the same amount of liquid, that sort of thing. So he was more focused on that cognitive piece. But Keegan now brings those together, and I think has offered us really quite an artful and profound kind of a way to understand the interplay of those two aspects of the human being in their evolving nature. And he's got some ways, some kind of handles that help me understand, and I've been looking at this for a number of years, so please feel comfortable if it's confusing or whatever, and ask as many questions as comes to mind, because the system itself is both, I think, elegant in this way, but can be take a while to kind of grab a hold of. It starts with the idea that in the symbiotic stage, that is where mother and child are one during pregnancy, that there's that the fundamental experience of self is one of being incorporated in the mother. So it starts there at the bottom, where the two selves, the child and the mother, are one, really one person. And many people have described that stage in different ways, like paradise, where the needs of the child are automatically, you know, met, breathing, nutrition, everything is right there. What a deal, you know. Plus you get carried around. It wrecks mother's backs, but hey, it works for a while. But there's a, you know, if that starts the learning process, and we certainly don't know when awareness or memory and all that really, really begins, there's more and more suggestion that the in utero, you know, the gestation period is very significant, and so mothers are playing music, wearing heart sounds, you know, next to them, stuff like that. But if that's the starting point, then the first achievement that Keegan would say would be a movement to the first stage, which would be the impulsive stage. And the key phrases for that is that the child is her impulses versus having impulses. And we're going to look at these words with two sides of a continuum, that the stage is initiated when the child has the impulses, and it moves towards, or is the impulses, and it moves towards having the impulses. And that's what's central about the impulsive stage. Okay. Now, earlier than that, and really very soon, you know, with birth, we have our reflectives, or our reflexes. And those are our most basic, fundamental ways of, like closing our eyes during, you know, with bright light, seeking food when we're hungry, breathing when we feel oxygen deprivation, and so that's the most fundamental, biologically rooted experience of self. But then there's a then we realize, which is a funny word to use for infants, but about first 6 months, there is this emergence of an impulsive self. And what he says is it's just an awareness, basically, that there are these impulses. And so a child will cry. You get, in this particular stage, things like separation anxiety or stranger anxiety, that sort of a thing, where there's a beginning sense, so that the circle is, there's still a beginning sense that there are other people in the world, but the experience of self has to do with the other as being an extension of one impulse, of one's impulses. So, for instance, up until about 3 years old, or actually 2 years old, is kind of the resolution of this stage. The child will experience the mother still as an extension of themselves. The mother is a source of nurture, emotionally, physically, or whatever else. And it's a happy stage. That's why I have a happy face, in the sense that as the environment is responsive to the child, that goes well. Of course, alarms will go off when things don't go well. Diapers dirty or tummy's empty or whatever else. And there's a sense, though, you see, because needs aren't met right away, there's a sense that those feelings may or may not be responded to. There's times of frustration or of unmet needs that the child begins to deal with. And it's the beginning sense, again, of that separateness that exists. Now, as adults, we can sort of, I think, regress almost and sense a part of ourselves that can sense that the impulsive child doesn't see another person as a distinct individual, obviously. But again, it's just an extension of their needs, really, we could say. And so as that moves on, we have... As a child grows, we move into the terrible twos, and that's where we have an unhappy face there, where people are, the others in the families, particularly the family members, are still an extension of the self, but there's a sense of agency and of willfulness, we might say, that's very natural, and this is where the child is defining themselves as their feelings, and we distinguish between impulse and feeling, because impulse is more like more primitive or more basic. Feeling has to do with what they want. They don't need a truck, but they might want a truck to play with, and so it's this has movement between being their feelings to having feelings, okay? And so there's often an unhappy relatedness to those around, and they're trying to establish themselves and their will and their own separateness. And so you get a pushing away, but a very sometimes two-year-olds, are the first adolescents you talk about, because they act as if they could do without you or they know the answers. But Keegan describes this in a way that I think is very interesting. Let me see if I can find it. Okay, he says, could the terrible twos, with their rampant negativism and declarations of no, be a communication to the old self, now gradually becoming object, meaning, I'll explain that later, more than to those exasperated parents who feel they are being defied as distinct and separate people. When the new balance becomes more secure, the infant will have less of a need to protest too much, and the parents will become others rather than not me's. Okay, it's all psychobabble for if the child is experiencing the parents as an extension of self, then the first movement in changing that organization or in creating a different meaning of the self is to experience the parent as not me. Okay, and so the not me, though, is a source of a lot of anger. I need something, my mommy says no. And so he's suggesting that the two-year-old's contrariness may be, in fact, them saying no to their old self, who tried to see other people as an extension of themselves, which isn't working anymore. See, and that's the whole point of this evolutionary thing, is these certain points of organization or of meaning need to evolve because they don't work very well. I mean, if a two-year personality stayed as the central organization of an individual, they wouldn't get along very well in the world. See, so there's a running out, a usefulness that doesn't, doesn't work, a usefulness that runs out in these different organizations. And so that's another way to understand that particular, stage.
I have a question. Sure. About the earlier, when you're talking about the extension of self, how does that apply to babies that are in, say, in foster care, in which the caregiver changes, or even in extended daycare situations, in which the caregiver is other than the parent?
Yes. Yeah. It's a good question. He would suggest that it's pretty good. Between 0 and 6 months, but there needs to be a pretty consistent contact. It doesn't have to be an all-day contact, but a primary care contact. There's a sense that the parent is still the primary caregiver, which is somewhat confused. With someone who's there all day, whatnot, because in these stages, the child is always wrestling with the reality of the consistent other in their life, and that always has to do with a dependency towards the parents and working towards greater and greater independence, which is part of the challenge to just make that happen. So, see you later. See you later.
Well, what about I think of our our child welfare organizations that seem to have no regard for keeping a child in a permanent situation.
Oh, yeah.
And you may have a baby that's placed in foster care from birth, maybe with one caregiver for 2 months, and then for whatever reason is with somebody else for 2 weeks and so on. How is it just the need? I mean, do they kind of connect to whoever's giving the care? It just seems like, if this is such a crucial stage,
Sure. Yeah, it's good. It's a good question. You can look at other cultures too, like Israeli and the kibbutz and things like that. But still, you're raising an important question of the consistency of the environment, and the regularity of that. I think issues of adoption and a lot of change, say in a foster care situation, that sort of stuff. I think that's very disturbing to this kind of a process, because you need that stable, we call it object, which means that stable other person to fight against, for instance, in this imperial stage. You see, and what you need is three things that are real important in all these stages. One is. What Keegan talks about as a holding experience, which means that the environment is somewhat consistent, and you can be yourself in that environment and experience yourself without fear of survival, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of basic holding thing, and as we were saying yesterday, the adequate level of that is fairly broad. Okay, so that has to do at these levels with. Food, warmth, diapers being changed, things like that, and that generally will be there even in
right. And that's environment. Situations. That's not personality or specific individuals.
Yeah, exactly. But then, and beyond that, we really get into the capacity of the caregivers, really the personal capacity to provide these other things. The other thing would be what he calls confrontation. Which basically means that the baby can't stay incorporated, nor is the mother an actual extension of the child's impulses. Okay? And there's all sorts of things like, no, mommy can't do this now, or no, daddy can't do this now. It's that kind of limit setting, basically, that continues to confront the child with the limitations of the way that they have organized themselves. Okay. And it's that, and what sometimes parents run into is a struggle in dealing with that limitation within themselves or that separateness. And so, if this is difficult for a parent, then they could do, they could become like a slave to the child, or you see sometimes where children are in charge of the parents, that kind of thing. Okay. And then the third part of that
would be ongoing contact. Right, here we go again. I'm just call it ongoing support. This isn't exactly Keegan's language, but this is the idea. It's staying with the child as they go through these, and adolescence is obviously the toughest one, but these reorganizations of self. And even at this, with the, you know, with the terrible twos, there's still a sense of, you know, do I take it back to the hospital? I mean, what's, are we gonna survive this thing? And it's this capacity of the adult to stay in a supportive, which goes back to the holding, but like you say, not just in the physical ways. This is the more emotional support that says, that has some understanding of, it doesn't have to be these cycles, but just that there's this evolving self in the child. And so these three things are very important in all of these stages for the child to complete and work through these different stages. So, you know, in terms of those alternatives, I think I would say the crucial thing is the availability of a adequately mature adult. See, and I think in some ways that can be somewhat transferable because you see, this may be good news and bad news, but in the impulsive stage, you see the nurturing person is not totally interchangeable, but the child doesn't necessarily, you know, experiencing in the other. It experiences the outside world as an extension of their needs. And this model is a little less concerned, you know, or that the mother-child bond is like ultimate. Mm-hmm. It's a little less, you know, intense about that. But the need for adequate physical holding, you know, physical environment, consistent limits, and ongoing support. Those are kind of the three elements that need to be there. So it moves on, you know, and the period of the terrible twos then would resolve itself in terms of being one's feelings to having feelings, and then that would allow the individual to enter the possibility of recognizing the presence of other people. Now, but the interpersonal phase, as we have it up there, would be characterized not necessarily by a close intimacy, but rather as with fusion. Fusion would be kind of the sense of this stage. That is that I exist, the child's meaning would have to do with I exist in or to the degree that I'm relating to other people, and that I have a role with them, and that I'm recognized and responded to and given messages that I belong. This would be more typical of the later childhood, early adolescent stages, where the group becomes the young person's identity, really. We put a question mark for the self, because that's where confused boundaries often exist in this stage, where it's not so much who am I as the beginnings of how am I is there, and there's still an embeddedness in that internal experience of feeling good. So for instance, this stage can be that's why adolescents are so susceptible to, you know, wearing the right clothes and getting the right response from particularly their peers, is because in order to feel good about themselves, they need that kind of external feedback to feel good about themselves. Because they're organized in a way that says, I am my relationships, and that's I am versus I have. So when you are your relationships, then there's this this fusion. That's why teenagers spend all the time on the phone, typically. See, they just or for males, and there's the difference, of course, with males and females. But for males, there's often an agonizing sense of isolation, and yet a preoccupation with how do I belong, how do I fit in, what's my position, and so forth. So all these are important stages. I mean, they're kind of inevitable, but however we can understand this, I think it helps us appreciate what our
what our young people are dealing with, and that there is, it isn't a personal, you know, attack on on us as parents is the main thing.
This might be a stupid question, but I mean, I'm assuming that that is always just the need to belong to the immediate
sure.
group, whatever's right. around them, and that they don't have any kind of a worldview.
Right, right.
Or a broader society, like that there's
right.
more than one place to belong. It's like they see what they see. And
yes, which is so important because, you see, and this is where I think we make a mistake when we even try to impose upon our adolescents. I mean, they're both, you know, young people and you know, emerging adults. But you say that so well, I think. There's just a narrowness there. It's me and Sally and, you know, it's us and what's happening now. And you know, that's why adolescents are so susceptible to fad. It's whatever's identified by the group as in, whether it's purple hair or whatever else. The self is organized in a way that the self is those relationships, and there is, just as you suggest, a lack of reflectivity with that. Okay,
but is social awareness then just a fad, sort of thing?
It can be, yeah.
It's
yeah.
like the whales is.
Yeah. Right.
What everybody else is doing, or
yeah, exactly, can be, and it isn't a pejorative thing or an evaluative or negative thing. It's it's just where they're at. It's where the self, what the self has a capacity to take in and to relate to, and you get the paradox though, don't you? With the particularly the adolescent and our whole culture pushing for into adulthood, and adulthood seeming to be grasped or wanted earlier and earlier. And yet I think this kind of scheme helps us appreciate kind of the slow baking of the self that goes on for quite a long time. And you're identifying very well the paradoxes in all of that.
So when your kids get to be that age, you better make sure they're in a good place, I guess. I mean,
that's helpful. Yeah,
take a
yeah.
good look at where
yes.
their peer groups is at that particular place.
That's a very clear. Yeah, that's a very clear. That's right. That's a very clear. Yeah.
It's hard.
And you hear that?
Hold it.
I hear you. It's the scariest thing because, and it's sort of, you know, you have some control over that, but that's the paradox. The more they move, because the imperial self has worked at being separate from parents, the interpersonal self will inevitably, this isn't a fusion back into the family, this is a fusion outside of the family. And that you have less and less leverage over.
What about this whole idea of, we live in an area that's mm-hmm. considered, you know, a good place for kids and all that.
Right.
But they've, I guess they've been bringing up groups of kids from inner city or wherever
mm-hmm.
That have been in trouble to kind of give
yeah.
them a better place to be, but they bring them in groups.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, is there a benefit?
Yeah.
It's almost just like transplanting the whole culture, and it's like, it doesn't mm-hmm. really matter the physical environment, it's...
Yeah.
If they're not taken out of that group, that's trouble. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean...
Well, and, yeah, and there's
how
where...
Do they do that?
Right. Yeah, that's, we'd have to ask the city planner or whoever is making those decisions. But... there is a basic optimism that the common human needs are still similar. That is the need to have a separate identity and also be connected or belong in a positive way. Now disturbed, you know, children, adolescents are going to be dangerous to be around because they'll have feelings that want to get even and act out deep. You know, we're talking, you know, serious kinds of levels of rage and violence if that's been their modeling. So I would have a lot of concern about certainly not isolating that, but I think on the hopeful side is that the common human needs and desires are really quite identifiable and much more common, you know, across even back.
What happens
different.
To the kids that are homeschooling is another big thing.
Yeah.
What,
right.
what happens to the kids that are denied to a large part of peer group?
Yeah, that's they're going to push. It's going to be okay through latency, pretty much, because the family
latency
is about 5 to 9, where six to nine. Where the child is basically developing their gender identity,
and are still utilizing the family as their primary resource, emotional information, education, etc. And it's kind of a honeymoon time for parenting.
Well, it seems to work at that point.
Yeah, exactly.
But like when you get into the...
Yeah, and that's the transition is the movement to the peer group. So I think homeschooling works okay, but it's there's still some dangers there.
Is it crippling to a kid not to have a peer group? I guess that's what I want to know. Or is it advantageous?
Sure. Well, it's a trade-off psychologically. See, because all of this deal with polarities and you emphasize the influence and security of the home, the consistency, all that stuff, the congruity, and yet you take away from the child the challenge to deal with the plurality of the world. So they're not going to, but you're gonna take them out of some challenging situations. So there is truly a trade-off. It's very hard to really predict or know. I mean, the information just isn't there to say what the effects are. But I think if we keep thinking in terms of balance and trade-offs, then I think it's more realistic. And again, with all the concept of what's adequate for the child.
Most people don't isolate their kids. I'm just thinking theoretically, if that's the all important thing at that stage, what if it's not there? Would they look to adults as?
They could. And see, one resolution is to just be, an extension of the adult world, and like the over good child, or the compliant child, isn't necessarily the most balanced child, because. But I would. Raise a concern of like a homeschool situation beyond 11 or 12, certainly, because I think then you're probably working against the natural need for organizing self or making meaning of self and others on another level. And if you're not providing an environment, as you're suggesting, then you're probably working against the natural flow.
Seems like you can homeschool and still have the social life.
Oh yeah, I know that's
still right.
Possible.
That's right, exactly, yeah. Sure. Yeah. But you do it deliberately, or there's a consciousness you bring to that to make sure that happens. Right.
It can happen naturally too.
Yeah.
We did it with our son. Freshman last year, and it was his only year he homeschooled. And
he had
already all his peer group established, and absolutely no difference. Mm-hmm. He still saw all the same people.
Yep.
And he was happier actually at home.
Good. Yeah.
And he still had his peer group. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's neat. Was his socializing time, like it was regular pretty much, right? It was after school and
right.
When he had people home.
Sports.
Yeah, huh? Interesting.
He was able to go up to school for certain things. He did a drama class and he was in a play and did sports, and those things were real important to him. And because we live really close to the school, all of those things were accessible to him and he had no problem.
That's great. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. And it's so again, there's a lot of different. It's very difficult to define an optimal or the best structure. Really is. But it gets back to it. And your question really comes from where's the danger points here, and where do we fall off the adequacy place? And I think that's a very important concern. But it's the balance, I think, understanding. That's why I want to talk about this particular business of the evolving selves going on. And probably our offspring will not resolve the interpersonal before they leave home. Okay, that is my guess psychologically. They probably won't go much beyond that. And so you get scary things like, adolescent romances, and sometimes the resolution of leaving home is to get married early. And that's concerning. Everybody knows that, because Keegan's team, there's still a stuckness in this interpersonal, and the person hasn't necessarily developed their own independent set of values, etc. But that's where the next level moves, and that's what he calls the institutional. What that basically means is that the self is being defined more clearly. That is the question, who am I? And not as a son of mom and dad or a member of this community or anything else, but it answers the question, who am I as an individual? And here you get sometimes the the very strong sense that happens in our culture, you know, I am a Lutheran, I am a Republican or Democrat, I am, you know, you describe yourself by the groups that you belong to. And here the issue of self-other relatedness has to do with who's the group you belong to and who's loyal to that group or not. It's also the seabed we could see of prejudice. For instance, in an out of balance position here, in this particular stage, we'd get the in group and the out group, those who believe correctly and those who are wrong, the right wrong kind of thinking. But the self, what the self needs, Keegan would suggest, is a more complete and coherent, let's say, set of beliefs and values and lifestyle that makes sense to the person. So again, it's the as we see these two sides, see, we move from separate, independent, autonomous, and agency-focused stuff, which back to this one, which is what you say is stage four, the institutional. It's this, you know, this is what I believe. And don't confuse me with the facts. I don't want to, you know, here's where, if somebody is really in the middle of this, cross-cultural stuff can be difficult. See, it can even be difficult to let yourself be open to what other cultures think. But the movement within that stage again is kind of a happy definition of self or institutional position. This is what I believe. This is my self-governing system. To again, that runs out, and there's an unhappiness. I wonder what it would be like to vote Democrat, or there's this natural interest. See, and here's where the self in creating meaning, I think, is always moving towards a more and more complex, a more diversified, a more inclusive. And say we move back over here, or connected relatedness to the world, which then would move to stage five, which he describes as the inter-individual. That is, there's a formation of the fairly complete self, and then there's this the movement to relate in true intimacy and true mutuality with other individuals who are respected in their own individuality and autonomy and whatnot. And here's where, and of course, it's dangerous to look at this as like, you know, the goal for health and all that sort of thing, because we're all involved with these stages at different times and
go back and forth.
Yeah, exactly. And there's this aspect of self. We always have. It's always functioning. We don't like do it and drop it and move on. It's
just like kids. Yeah. They're finished with something. Oh, well, there it is again.
Exactly. Yeah. And you get a trauma. And you get a slippage. Where the older organizations happen, because if we go back down, you know what we see is it's all based on survival, and maintaining the self system, just like our bodies if they're over traumatized, we go to shock, and we go into blood at the center of us, keeping warm, all that sort of stuff. So that's a good point, right? With children, you see it all the time.
Well, you know, I see some interpersonal 18 or 20 years old, and institutional kind of 30 years old, and kind of getting into the middle class there. I don't know whether.
I think so.
This interim individual.
Inter individual. Yeah, also known as
more mature.
Right. Right, interdependence, it's called. There's a lot of different words for it, but it's the ability to have a self. That's why we use two circles. That there's a self, and related to another self in a way that isn't overreactive. And this is why it's so crucial for marriage, for instance, to be able to handle, for instance, negative feedback in a way that, see, in the incorporated self or the interpersonal self, you get this sense that wow, if she doesn't like, you know, the way I spend money, then oh, I must be a terrible person. You see, it's over connected. Or if it's the incorporated self, then the person goes, I don't care what you think. This is what I think. You see, and just bounces off. And so you pointed to a very important implication here. And that's where that vulnerability comes in. It's a chosen vulnerability, as we say, because it's a realization, an organization of the self, that it's a multiverse. We are one note, let's say, in the symphony of life, whatever metaphor you want to use, but there's other equally valuable, you know, equally interesting, coherent, and
other points of integrity out there, meaning other people that are equally as valuable. Mm-hmm. And then that would be the basis then, in a spiritual sense, of true justice, developing policies or whatever else that are truly peaceful and stable because they have a recognition of that importance.
So you could actually accept Republicans.
This stage five suggests that, right.
Or at least
you wouldn't ever stop arguing with them, but you would actually wish them well.
That's right. You would love it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
recognize
another point of view, and that there's sometimes one way to it.
Yes.
To
yes.
Something.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So, and we see that the what I appreciate about this paradigm is we appreciate the struggle of the self, and particularly the self of our children, to grow into that kind of security. And the kind of meaning that says, I can be me, they can be them, we can relate. And in fact, we have so much to enrich each other from, or so much to learn from each other. You know, even a different point of view. Or it's really interesting to sit and listen to William Buckley. He's an interesting guy to listen to, sometimes, or whatever. But Rush Limbaugh, maybe that's something else. So there's that. That's that kind of the overall scheme. And again, I think we will deal with our children at home with those first three: the impulsive, the imperial, the interpersonal, and we do the holding and the limit setting. And this is where the ambivalence towards us as parents, you know, build up, and it should, because here's a child, first of all, who was given everything in their gestation and whatnot, and then mother becomes the no-sayer, the naysayer, you know, and father, the one who really introduces reality to that. No, you have to go to school. I don't want to go to school. No, I just want to go to school. Well, who said so? You know, who did I talk to? Who's in charge here?
That's sick. First you try mom, then you try dad.
Yeah. Yeah, it goes on and on. And we appreciate that because these simpler organizations are... they have their own, again, plus and minuses, but it's less complex those earlier stages, and we really struggle. I think as adults we can trace that. You know, we could trace our own passages and whatnot, and some are much more tumultuous than others. Our culture, it's interesting to put a cultural overlay on this. I think our culture is very much oriented. Both in the interpersonal, in terms of the romantic ideals, you know, and that kind of fusion, that particularly the senses of love, I think, are very much oriented there. If you look at, you know, all of the examples of romantic love that's soap operas, movies, a lot of literature and whatnot, has this fusion kind of thing to it, which was really a kind of a reincarnation, we might say, of the incorporated self, where there isn't boundaries, you see. But then I think a lot of, as you're saying, the kind of the middle age thing of the institutional self is the me generation, the gratification. I exist, and sure, other people exist, and they have a right to exist, but what I believe and think and need and experience is the main thing. I think our culture is really kind of in between those places a lot. And we don't get a lot of models, or, you know, God willing, I think the church tries to articulate movement to that inter-individual place, which is reflected. I think that is reflected scripturally in terms of in terms of God's relatedness. Is I think more of an inter-individual sort of thing. He certainly defines himself clearly, and as Jesus says throughout Scripture. Who do you say that I am? Do you believe? There's always this this confrontation of individual to individual. But it goes back to those three basic positions. You hold the child's process, recognize their struggle to organize themselves in different and different levels, and then you confront what isn't possible or what you're not able to be for them or do for them, and then continue to offer support and encouragement. So
this fits what I've heard about. Uh-huh. I've heard a lot of people talk about whose culture of origin, if you will, is different than the majority. they say, you know, early on the parents try to introduce them to different aspects of their culture.
Yes.
And that, you know, it's family's the primary unit and the whole thing, but then when they reach that interpersonal stage, it's like they reject anything that makes them different from their immediate peer group.
Right.
And then when they get to that institutional stage, they say, hey, you know, there's a part of me that belongs to to this culture.
Yes.
And they start to embrace it again and appreciate that.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, they don't use these terms, but it's like that's what I'm seeing there.
That fits very well to Keegan's what he's offering us, because right. And you also use the word, a lot of people use the word counterdependent, or just another scheme that fits into this with different words, is a dependent. Counterdependent, which includes both a rejection of the parental piece and a movement towards the peer. That's why you get in adolescence, you know, such strange things. It's just kind of, wow, what is it? It's bizarre. Because further on the other end of the spectrum does a couple things. They both experiment with life on that other side, but they're also establishing a separateness from their culture. I like your culture of origin or culture of embeddedness. Keegan uses that term a lot. And all these stages have to do with embedded in mother's body and movement out, embedded in this self-other symbiosis, and moving out of that, embedded in the feelings, you're moving out of that. So, and then, so it's dependent, counterdependent, and independent, which has to do with this institutional self, and then interdependent. Just another way of talking about that. That's
it. I'm wondering if it would be easier for children and parents to grow up in this culture if it weren't such a seemingly dysfunctional culture. You know, in other cultures, it seems like there isn't this big, huge adolescent
problem. That's true.
It's a real American problem.
I think you're right.
Well, yeah. In some other cultures, they really don't recognize the individual as.
Right.
I mean, you are part of a group your whole life, and you are already part of a pretty strict social order. So things are much more well-defined, less confusing. And many cultures have a much more homogeneous population. There's not all that diversity out there. I mean, it's not every culture, but...
It's a good comparison. You know, it's very interesting to do the cultural comparison, and because we're in these larger. I mean, like you say, the family culture, the community culture, which can describe just our immediate geography or our town, and our then the regional culture, the national culture, and it really it does. It's always a trade-off, and I think we can assess and even label in that sense or identify the dynamics with the different types. Individualism, that's the big thing. Yeah. So then see it. What's better is is being separate or independent.
It seems almost, and I've always liked that, I guess, until recently I've kind of felt like it even separates us from God.
Definitely. Oh yes, in extreme, right.
And I think that's a common actually our common dysfunction.
Yes,
culture.
Definitely.
And
it
really distresses me actually because I don't have the model that I want.
Gotcha,
I finally figured it out and the model isn't there for me. I didn't grow up with it.
Right. Yeah. That's and there is, I think there's a dearth of models that keep this tension together. As a family therapist, the theory I work with is called Bowenian theory, and it's centered very much on the separate connected sort of stuff, and it embraces that complexity or that polarity or even that paradox of human relatedness without lopping off one or the other, because I think that's the slippage that happens is if you go with autonomy and the rugged individual and all that stuff that our culture has gone, then it's hard to establish global citizenship
adequate relations on all levels, intimate community or whatever else.
You need to go on a search. I was in that class on stereotypes yesterday, and the leader of that said she would like a grant to go search the world for, you know, a culture that has the best racial and cultural relationships among groups. Mm-hmm. So you need to go with her. I'm looking for the good...
See, this is where, but I would suggest that's a holy disturbance because it, you know, it'd be another example of that ongoing.
Right.
Yeah, and it's that inner individual that's able to reflect back. See, I think that reflectivity is another very important part, and I think we're in the middle. As a pastoral counselor, where I see myself very much in the middle of a revolutionary attempt to be as fearlessly and, you know, both kind and affirming of what's good, but also very very evaluative of, let's say, what's adequate here, what's good relating, and I think we're in a very confrontive time. But also supporting ongoingly the business of ourselves as a culture, discovering more and more healthy ways of relating. It's kind of exciting, but it's where's the book? Like you say, where's the example of it? But I think models like this give us a support us as individuals in. And hopefully good theology does too, which we'll be talking about some more tomorrow morning, kind of healthy versus, that's always a pejorative word, but maybe theologies are a little more in tune with this.